This podcast is proudly supported by iLevel. iLevel's new innovative interactive video platform allows you to showcase your business knowledge. To learn more and view AmCham's interactive video, visit ilevelstudio.com.au/platform. Welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia, where you find out how business really works. AmCham podcasts are hosted by Dr. Duff Watkins. Duff is a director of Exec Search International, an author, and is also on the AmCham Council of Governors. AmCham, bringing business to you.
Hello and welcome to the How Business Really Works podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. Today we discuss the science of business and business of science. We ask, can a CEO be a scientist, or for that matter, can a scientist be a CEO? Come to think of it, what does science know about business? Seriously, what do they contribute? A lot, as it turns out, and as you are about to find out. My name is Duff Watkins. I'm the host of the AmCham Business Podcast. Today, our guest is Dr. Larry Marshall of the CSIRO. The CSIRO is Australia's National Science Agency and Innovation Centre. They're Australian in origin, but international in impact. Let me prove it to you. If you've ever used Wi-Fi, that was developed at the CSIRO. If you use plastic banknotes to pay for things, that too was developed at the CSIRO. If you use extended wear contact lenses, that too was developed at the CSIRO. So, listener, do you have a national science agency that has global impact like that? No, I didn't think so. Larry, welcome to the show. Good to see you again.
Great to see you too, Duff, and thanks for having me.
Larry, I don't understand. You're a scientist and a CEO. Now, let me just talk about the science bit, for example. You have a doctorate. I have a doctorate, too. My doctorate's in a soft science, psychotherapy. Yours is in a hard science, physics. I have an academic publication. You have 100 peer-reviewed publications, and you hold 20 patents. It's like I was drinking wine and you were drinking whiskey, the hard stuff. That's a whole career in science, and yet, simultaneously, you've also developed a career in business. You have started up or been a senior manager on companies that were involved in biotechnology, photonics, telecommunications, semiconductors. You have served on 20 boards. You ran a venture capital company that had offices in Shanghai, Silicon Valley, and Sydney. Those are two separate careers. Plus, you're younger than me. I don't understand. There's got to be a story there.
No, I just look younger than you, Duff. So doing a degree in physics, doing a PhD in physics, teaches you that you can pretty much understand anything. And you think about it from quantum physics to how the universe works to gravity to designing semiconductors, all of that stuff that we call technology today, that all came from physics. So I was always drawn to that subject area, and I think that's part of the magic. You know, the physicists have taken over Wall Street, for example.
I did not know that.
Not an obvious connection for science. But it's because when you learn physics, you get taught to analyze things from the bottom up to really deeply understand them. So I don't really see a barrier between science and business. And hopefully over the podcast, I can convince you why that is.
Well, you came back from the U.S., as I recall, to take on the CSIRO. And once again, that stands for the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization. It's a government agency that basically invents and innovates things for our listeners. Now, what brought you back? Why did you take the job?
Well, CSIRO was in trouble, and I think it, in a sense, was looking for a new direction. It needed to change. I cut my teeth in science at CSIRO in 1984, so I've always had a great fondness for the organisation, as most Australians do. I saw a huge opportunity to kind of change CSIRO's direction and help it deliver even greater impact over the next 100 years than what it's delivered over the last 100. Now, that's a tall order, but again, physicists tend to think big. I mean, last year we contributed to the discovery of gravity waves, which may be the biggest discovery in science of the century. Mm-hmm. So we definitely are trained to think big.
Okay, so you're doing your PhD in physics, you're working on lasers, and somehow, though, you make the jump to business. Now, in my experience, most scientists like doing science, and they prefer that channel. Somehow you've not just crossed over, but blended the two, and that's your point, that they're not segregated, distinct, antithetical, that they actually have a lot in common.
No, exactly. And look, as a chief executive, it's incredibly important to be able to measure everything. You know, you need metrics. You need to be able to really measure your impact on a business and the business performance. Otherwise, it's too easy to drink your own Kool-Aid. So that instinct to measure is the scientific method. I think that training in science has really been a foundation for my career. I've noticed in coming back to Australia that there's a tendency to put people in boxes, like, you know, if you're a scientist, you can't be a business person. If you're a politician, you can't be a business person. Now, that one may be true, but certainly, there's an artificial barrier separating science from business. And, you know, if you look at the United States, US got over this separation anxiety 30 years ago. Silicon Valley was formed on the premise that people working at Stanford on the lab bench had great ideas and could really change the world with them. And so that artificial barrier blurred out, that hasn't happened here. We still have to go through that transition, I think.
I know that in Silicon Valley, CEO scientists are quite common. And I guess that doesn't really surprise you, because that's where a lot of technology is science-driven. In fact, if I understand you correctly, you're really all about science-driven innovation. Innovation, of course, is a buzzword necessarily in the business world, but you're suggesting that science drives a lot of this innovation.
Yeah, exactly. And it's from what I learned in the 80s in the Valley, hanging out at Stanford, sneaking into business school classes at Stanford, listening to people like Jim Collins talk about what's a real CEO look like. And it's not what generally we see as the stereotypical image of a CEO. You know, it's not Lee Iacocca, it's not chest-thumping quarterback. It's someone who has the ability to, in a way, see the future, certainly for their market, to understand the challenges in their market, to see the future, to see the challenges, to get around them and turn those challenges into an advantage and to get there ahead of the pack and to kind of bring people on the journey. Now, there is a sort of a standard saying in the world that, you know, scientists don't make very good managers. And there are reasons why that stereotype exists, but it's a stereotype. It doesn't have to be that way. And what I saw in Silicon Valley in the 80s was professors from Stanford go out and found multi-billion dollar companies and then go back and teach at Stanford 10, 20 years later. Look at Steve Blank, who invented the lean launchpad method. He's now back at Stanford being a professor again. He was very inspirational in early 2000s, by the way, in building this bridge between the amazing science on a lab bench and delivering it to impact. See, that's the thing. Everything that we take for granted today, mobile phones, the internet, optical fiber communications, the computer, they all got invented by scientists, many of them at universities like Stanford and Berkeley in California. It's only an artificial perception that keeps those scientists from stepping out of the lab to invent. In my career, you know, I did do 100 papers, but after a while I realized, you know, that's not a good way to measure impact. A CEO would never measure and inputs, writing a paper, as the metrics for a business. So I started measuring myself on a different metric was, you know, what am I doing with the science? Mm-hmm. What am I delivering with it? And that's what led to the iSafe laser and actually putting that out into the world so that lasers could be used much more widely and used safely without blinding people. It's what led to inventing the solid-state green laser, which cures blindness in diabetics. Those products would never have happened, though, if I hadn't had that exposure to a different way of thinking at Stanford, that science and business are the same.
Larry, why does the stereotype of scientist persists? You've worked in three different cultures that I know of. You've been on 20 boards in three different countries. So, and yet the perception of scientists differs per culture, per country.
Yeah, and that is a challenging one. But I'd say that in the United States, where investors, bankers, the public, and business people have experienced the pure value creation that happens when science makes a breakthrough. When they've gone on that journey, it's a lot easier for them to break that artificial mindset barrier, to stop putting people in a box that says scientist, lawyer, business person, whatever. In Australia, for example, we haven't experienced that type of value creation from science. You know, our venture capital community, our superannuations funds management community, those people haven't personally experienced that type of value creation, so they're very reluctant to invest in science and makes it hard for them to believe that scientists can deliver those types of business returns. Now, If you go back to Silicon Valley in the 80s, it was different to that. People had started to experience value creation. It changed the culture. You asked me earlier why I came back to CSIRO. I believe that CSIRO can really be a leader, a catalyst, if you like, in shifting that culture. If you look at what we've already done in the organization, we've put about 10% of CSIRO through a thing we call the ON program, and their culture has changed. Their understanding of customer and customer centricity, their understanding of science to deliver impact has fundamentally changed. And as a result, they're delivering more for the country, more for the organization. So I think we can be a catalyst for that change.
Well, it certainly isn't that we lack scientific expertise in this country, because Australian scientists, and what I mean by this, Australia is a small country with a small population, but it punches well above its weight in terms of scientific contribution and input. And yet, I must confess, I when I think of scientists, I think of some geeky, nerdy guy in a white coat who could easily be misperceived as a dentist, and they're working on things which I don't understand and don't have any interest in, and there is a disconnect there. And I'm wondering how that stereotype, which is wrong, how it persists and what we can do about it.
You know, in an age of innovation where everything is changing constantly, got to break down the stereotypes. Got to be a lot more diverse in our understanding of what a CEO is and what business is. One of the other things I really learned from the Valley, which I've applied to CSIRO, is the power of a market vision, or if you like, a market roadmap. Generally, scientists work on things that they're passionate about, and that's called curiosity-driven science. And it's wonderful, pure creation of ideas. But it's equally wonderful if you can inspire a scientist to be interested in solving a business problem. It's every bit as important a science, but the difference is it's no longer a solution looking for a problem. It actually has a profound impact if the problem can be solved. And I think that's the subtle mind shift that we need to go through.
That's my understanding of the difference between invention and innovation, that a scientist may pursue something that they're passionately interested in and invent something, but an innovation actually is the solution to a problem. There's a problem begging for a solution out there, and somebody comes up with a clever solution. Is that correct?
Exactly.
I read it in a science book, so it must be true.
It's exactly right. And we got a lot of criticism about our shift in climate science last year. But fundamentally, we shifted from pure science, if you like, to solutions. In reality, it was a relatively small shift, created a lot of noise, but the win, the big leap forward that we've had is that shift has now touched, it's delivered solutions to agriculture, to the mining industry, broad public good solutions for the environment. It's helping farmers navigate climate variability through the seasons. We've developed a polymer soil cover that traps the water in the soil, prevents sedimentary runoff to damage the Great Barrier Reef, and increases crop yields. So, small shift, and those scientists, I think, are genuinely just as inspired by solving those problems for the nation as they were creating pure science. There are 41 universities in Australia, and God bless them because they create the pure science. CSIRO is different. CSIRO has got to be solutions from science.
These aren't just good ideas. These are bloody clever applications solving real-world problems in real time, which affect, well, every citizen every person on the planet, really, such as preserving the Great Barrier Reef. So what we're really talking about is the commercial application of real science in real time. Is that a fair description?
So that's one part of it, but not everything is commercial. So we're working on a big idea around the Great Barrier Reef. We're doing it extremely collaboratively across the sector, but we're trying to figure out how do we save the reef? We have enough science capability. We can see a path forward, but it's going to take the combined power of the innovation system really focused on that challenge to deliver the solution. That's not a commercial outcome. I mean, it's true to say, you know, the reef is somewhere between $6 billion and $50 billion of economic value if you wanted to measure it. But it's not a commercial outcome. It's a save the environment, save the reef outcome. There are other areas like the Murray-Darling irrigation area, mm-hmm. like the development of Northern Australia. They're not necessarily commercial outcomes, but they are delivering real-world solutions from the science So from a public perspective, public benefit, they're massive public benefit. I'll just give you one more. Health. Our health system, like most, focuses a lot on treating someone once they're sick. But we believe science has the ability to actually keep you well, mm-hmm. keep you out of hospital. And the economic benefit to the country is massive for that. But it's very hard to build a business in that area. So I don't want you to think that CSIRO is all commercial. About half what we do is purely industry focused, or largely industry focused. About half what we do is public good focused. But everything that we do, everything is designed to deliver benefit to Australia, to deliver national benefit or public benefit.
It sounds like half is commercial and half is saving the world. I can live with that, Larry. That's fine. That's fine. I can accommodate that. And we'll take a brief pause here for a commercial.
This October, join AmCham in Boston and Silicon Valley as we uncover the secrets that have made America's tech giants so successful. AmCham's annual innovation mission returns again this year, from October 29th to November 3rd. Don't miss out. To find out more, visit amcham.com.au.
Larry, how do other cultures see scientist CEOs? You're not exactly a pink unicorn. There are other scientist CEOs out there. It's just they're not always in the press, or even if they are, I suppose we perceive them as business people first and foremost and exclusively. But that isn't, or is it the case in other cultures as well?
There's definitely that stereotype. I don't ever use the term nerd, and I laugh when I hear it here because, you know, in Silicon Valley, the people that get called nerds here drive Ferraris, live in mansions, and the bankers and the lawyers chase them looking for the next deal.
I meant no disrespect to all the nerds out there.
And in terms of scientist CEOs, you know, Elon Musk is the classic. So I'm thinking of, you know, SolarCity, SpaceX and Tesla. And Elon was totally a scientist at Stanford. He was one of the founding team at PayPal, but also the legendary founder and CEO of Intel. Again, classic scientist. So in the Silicon Valley part of the US, I think that barrier has definitely been broken. We are probably 20, maybe 25 years behind there. But the great thing, when I look at what CSIRO is doing as a catalyst, I mentioned the ON program. You know, 30 of those 41 universities are in boots and all in ON. So it's a highly collaborative thing. In a country that's the lowest in the OECD for collaboration, that program really stands out because everyone's contributing to it. And that's causing a culture change in those universities as well. So to me, it starts to look a lot like Silicon Valley did back in the 80s. Like that embryonic sort of phase of change. I think we've figured it out for digital technology. You know, Atlassian, Mike Cannon-Brookes, founding CEO, no CEO experience, no business experience, but a great CEO. Mike's not a scientist, although I could call him a computer scientist. So we've broken that barrier, I think, in digital, but we haven't broken it in the rest of science. Adrian Turner, who runs Data61, was one of my first investees in my venture fund. Was hard work bringing Adrian back, but he's changing the culture in the digital space in a really profound way. We have another great leader in our health business, Rob, who's a doctor. He's changing the culture in our health business by bringing this different way of thinking about science delivering solutions that really benefit the nation.
One of the secrets, or something people don't know much about Silicon Valley, is that it is heavily funded, heavily invested in by the U.S. government. It is not, everyone thinks it's a bunch of entrepreneurs, you know, striking it rich, really smart and getting lucky, but no, the government is a major investor in that. Now, CSIRO, or CSIRO as it's sometimes called, is actually a government agency, and yet it has it's not a company, it has a business presence. How on earth do you go about running a government agency, facing the challenges that it does, trying to make it more business-like or more commercial, if that's the correct term?
No. CSIRO is a unique entity. And the UK had a CSIRO and they disbanded it, and now they're putting it back together into kind of a super CSIRO. So it's hard to believe, but globally, we benchmark very high amongst our peers. It's why we made last year a list that we've never been on before, which is on the world's top 20 innovation organizations, which is a great sort of indication of the strategy. But CSIRO is a unique entity because the Australian government is our biggest customer, but we have a board of directors, we have a chair, we have a management team, and we operate like any other business, except our business is science. So it really is, again, a great example of the need to break that barrier of separation between the two. CSIRO, I think, has done that really well, but there are still many, many things to fix. One of them, for example, there are many rules. There's a ton of red tape from the government part of our business. A lot of it's there to protect us and for good reason, so we respect that. But there's many, many cases where we can cut through that, where we can make things more efficient. And we've done that with Data 61. It operates kind of in a sandbox.
You'll have to tell me what is Data 61. Sorry, Larry, I'm not familiar with that one.
Sure. So it's the biggest digital science group in the country. It's about 1,000 people. It's part of CSIRO, and its purpose, it interacts in each market vertical that CSIRO operates. So it touches the whole of CSIRO and all 3,000 CSIRO customers and pretty much all six of the major industries in Australia, from agriculture to mining to cybersecurity. So it's a great example of a highly collaborative way of doing science and delivering solutions from science in the digital space. It's basically helping Australia navigate through things like, we know 40% of the jobs that we know today will be gone in 10 years. How do we deal with that? It's trying to navigate through that, trying to answer those questions.
And the premise is that collaboration among scientists and business people expedites the process, so we get to solutions faster.
Yeah, absolutely. And scientists that get inspired by pure thought do great contributions to knowledge, public good science. But equally well, scientists that get inspired by industry problems can equally well do great pure science, great public good, or great commercial outcomes. We just need a balance between the two. And I think we really have that balance right now.
Well, let's talk about the future then. Every time I pick up a newspaper, well, metaphorically, because I read everything online now, you hear about these STEM skills. Now, STEM, in terms of education, is science, technology, engineering, mathematics, all the stuff that I found so hard in high school and college. In fact, full disclosure, Larry, I almost flunked that chemistry course in high school. I mean, when I got to university, I took one course in the science building. I looked around and said, I don't belong here. I immediately went back to the liberal arts and started writing my essays. Now, not everyone, I hate to be the one to break this to you, not everyone is going to be a scientist, Larry, and certainly not everyone's going to be leading a science company. So what is so important about these STEM skills, and what about all the people who don't gravitate to them?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So I think STEM, basic science, you know, mathematics, engineering, physics, chemistry, I think everyone should have that grounding in their education, because it teaches you a way of problem solving. Physics, again, was my love, because physics confronts you with a seemingly unsolvable problem. And the natural human reaction to that is, oh, run away. Physics teaches you, no, never run away. You can solve this. And it gives you techniques to go in and unravel the most complicated problems. Now, business, particularly in an innovation revolution, business throws you those types of insolvable problems every single day, just about every single hour. So for me, having that basic foundational understanding of STEM skills, I think it's invaluable to navigating the next 10, 50 years of the innovation revolution.
So how do we recruit or interest, motivate kids to be more interested in this? I mean, because frankly, I can remember it well. I was back in high school and I just freaked out. It was the first time I'd ever had a course that I couldn't understand. It didn't hold me back in life too much, but if you have those experiences with science as a kid and you find them daunting and they become impediments to knowledge, and you start avoiding them,
that's the danger. And anytime we bury our head in the sands, you know, the change is going to happen whether we like it or not. The difference is we can be prepared for it or we can be crushed by it. And teaching kids not to be afraid to stare it down, to look it in the eye with confidence and skills that they can actually navigate any change. I was just going to say on education, CSIRO does a lot of work in education. I believe profoundly that that's a key to the success, not just of CSIRO, but to the nation. Now, when I talk about a lot of work that CSIRO does, we do thousands of school visits every year to try and address the gap that most science teachers didn't study at university, the subject that they're teaching. So it's very rare to meet a physics high school teacher that actually majored in physics in university. We share with them, we collaborate with them, we support them to help them fill the gap, so that the kids can get a better educational experience. It's really important for our future, because those kids, if they're inspired by science, if they're inspired by solving big, seemingly insolvable problems, Australia will get better. Australia will become an innovation nation, and we will be a better country as a result.
Who is doing it right? In your travels around the world, what society or culture or country is best practice in terms of educating their population in terms of science, perhaps starting out as very early in school?
Yeah, so I like the Nordic countries, Finland, and actually in areas like food innovation, they're the best in the world, which is astounding considering per capita, they're a very small population, but they have a profound impact. I think California had it right probably 10, 15 years ago. I am worried about California now, hoping that they'll switch back. I think Israel has it right.
You mentioned that the CSIRO is on the cracked list of top 20 most innovative centers. Who among there on that list is doing it right? And what makes them so special?
So there's a couple of lists. One is the Reuters, Thomson Reuters list. The other is the IEEE list. On the IEEE list where there were Stanford and Harvard, and I think they're definitely doing it right. On the Reuters list where they're with NASA. And if you look at anyone who can put man on the moon gets my vote.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yes,
they're an amazing organization. Mm-hmm. And we're going to Mars. But they have an amazing school outreach program as well. Again, like ours, aimed at filling the gap, but also inspiring the kids. And what's not to inspire about space? We find NASA incredibly, we've got a 50-year relationship with NASA. CSIRO really is, the foundational space organization in the country. We provide all the radio telescopes, all the communication, telemetry and so on, which is why we have this 50-year partnership with NASA. But it gives us, when you go into schools and even businesses, it's amazing how even the hardest-nosed business person is absolutely fascinated with space. And it's a great way to engage them. And it's certainly a fabulous way to inspire kids. Mm. So we learned a lot from NASA in the power of space to inspire.
As I understand it, you currently lead a team of scientist leaders, and they in turn lead a team of scientists. But seriously, what do they know about business? I keep coming back to that. I just can't get over that stereotype.
Sure. So we changed the structure of CSIRO. And again, this was somewhat controversial, but CSIRO used to be structured like a university by academic disciplines, so physics, chemistry, math, and so on. When Jeff, two CEOs before me, came in, they developed a thing called the Flagship Program, which tried to connect the silos together, and they're called flagships. The restructure that we did was kind of what Hewlett-Packard did years ago. Basically said, you know what, if we're about solutions, then we need to structure into market verticals. So it's a simple structure. We have agriculture, we have energy, we have minerals, we have health, we have digital or data 61. But each of those business units, each of those market verticals has everything in it that it needs to address the market specific challenges of the market that they're addressing, whether it's the industries in, say, agriculture or the environment or the public good outcomes from agriculture. Everything that it needs is in that BU. And the types of leaders that we brought in to run those BUs tend to be, I don't want to sound arrogant, but they're kind of a little bit people like me. So they're scientists who've gone on that sort of evolution, who've shifted their way of thinking. So they still care passionately about science, but they care equally passionately about delivering solutions. And that's the shift. By the way, if you go back 40 years, that's what CSIRO looked like 40 years ago. So it's kind of a shift back to the past, in a way, but in a different world, in a different context.
Okay, now let me ask you a similar question, but from the other angle. What do business people need to know about scientists?
In, say, the last 50 years, you could say fairly that Australia largely hasn't had to compete. And it's a broad statement, but, you know, many of our businesses tend to enjoy oligopoly status, or distance separation from the world makes it easier to get on without fierce global competition. That isn't true anymore. You know, the world's flat. Your competitor can be anywhere in the world, and you may not even know that they're competing against you. Digital technology has changed that sort of fundamentally. So if I contrast to, say, US or Israeli companies, they are not afraid of competition. They actually hunger for it. They aren't frightened by seemingly overwhelming obstacles or insoluble problems because they've embraced those scientific disciplines, those skills, to go and solve something that we think is impossible. I think Australian business needs to go through that journey as well. And it's not a criticism of Australian business. Business everywhere, it's like evolution. It evolves and morphs to suit the environment that it's in. The problem is the environment has fundamentally shifted. And I saw this over the last two decades in the United States. US businesses got caught completely flat-footed by the internet. They're still getting caught flat-footed, but they have learned. I think Australian businesses are going to be really, really shocked at how quickly they get disrupted and disintermediated by those types of technologies. If they don't embrace the power of science to navigate them, I think that a lot of businesses will go out of business.
Well, it's happening now, and as you say, that there's nothing new about change in business, but the pace, the speed, the rapidity, and the profound impact of the change is what's new.
Right.
And it can happen so fast, and so many things can happen.
Right, exactly. And I was talking to David, my chairman, who used to run Telstra, and giving him the sort of perspective of your competitor is no longer a rival phone company. It's Google, it's Amazon, it's Twitter, it's Facebook. They're not even in your market, but if you're not careful, they will own you. And this is the other thing about, I mentioned back to the artificial barrier. I got a bit of pushback when I came back to Australia about, well, you know, you're a startup guy, biggest company you ever ran had 300 people. How are you going to run 5,500? If there's another sort of artificial barrier that says you can't run a big company if you've only ever run small companies. Small companies are going to own the future. That's their startups, they're the innovative companies. It's about time that big companies start getting run by small company, by startup type people, because they know how to navigate that type of profound disruption, profound change.
As we finish up here, Larry, is there one takeaway that you would like to leave with our audience, which, by the way, is international and probably more business people than scientists?
I guess the main message is STEM skills teach you a deep understanding of how things work. They give you the ability to solve pretty much any problem, even ones that seem insoluble. And they also give you a way, in a sense, to predict where things are going, to predict, if you like, the future. I think those skills are invaluable in any business that's subject to disruption through the innovation revolution. So I think businesses really need to embrace STEM skills and wipe out this artificial mindset barrier that says a scientist can't be a business person, because it's just not true.
Yes, and we're seeing evidence of that every day all around the world. Oh, one last question. Are there really scientists on Wall Street?
Sure. So there are a lot of mathematicians as well, but many of the quant models, you cannot imagine how much artificial intelligence and deep learning, machine learning algorithms, but it's also fundamental physics. It's called stochastic system. You'd be stunned how many physicists, PhD physicists, are in or even running Wall Street investment banks now. So that's a profound, if anything is going to break that artificial barrier, I think that fact would help.
That's the best news I've heard all day, Larry. I always thought Wall Street was run by criminals, and turns out now it's scientists. So we're saved. We'll finish on that note. You've been listening to the Business Podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. Today, our guest has been Dr. Larry Marshall of CSIRO. For more information about the CSIRO, you can go to their website. They were, by the way, the very first organization to have a website in Australia. It's csiro.au. Nope, that's it, csiro.au. We value your opinion. If you're listening to us through iTunes, you can easily hit the subscribe button, leave a review, make a comment, all of which are very appreciated, because we want to know what you want to know. You tell us what are the issues, the people, the topics that are of interest to you. Just email us, podcast@amcham.com.au. In fact, all of the podcasts are on the website, amcham.com.au. This is AmCham bringing business to you. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Business Podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. This podcast is proudly supported by Twitter Australia. Twitter connects everyone to what's happening in the world right now, from breaking news and entertainment to sports and other everyday topics. See what's happening in the world live as it unfolds. AmCham, bringing business to you.